We begin today on the south side of Chicago in Dawes Park. It's summertime, a bunch of teenagers are playing basketball. Some younger kids are hanging around nearby. They're just goofing off, and when they see a microphone, they do what kids often do. They yell into it.
It's all about the music, boy!
It's the kind of neighborhood where growing up can be very hard. Just ask the guys on the court.
Living in Chicago, it's a whole bunch, like, you know what I'm saying? You young and you black, you gotta watch your back at all times. But at the same time, you know, you gotta always just try to be on something positive, because there's gonna always be something negative out here. That's why everybody be trying to be coming to the court, do something positive or something.
Can I ask your name?
Yeah, my name is Deontay the Great Griffin. D-E-O-N-T-E, the Great D-E-G-R-A-T-E, Griffin. You know, that's worldwide.
Deontay the Great Griffin is 18 years old. He recently graduated from high school, but not in Chicago. He grew up here, but a few years ago, he left for Atlanta when one of his friends was shot and killed. The friend was 13.
Like, my dad ain't want me to go to high school down here just because it's just so crazy.
That's the thing about Chicago. It's pretty dangerous. Now, how dangerous is it compared to, say, New York?
Well, relative to New York, it is amazingly dangerous. The homicide rates in Chicago are roughly 3 times higher per capita than the homicide rates in New York, believe it or not.
That's Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's taught economics for years at the University of Chicago with a particular focus on crime. According to FBI data, the homicide rate in Chicago is 18.5 per 100,000 people. In New York, it's just 5.1.
The big difference when you look at who's murdering and being murdered is that Chicago has very active gangs, very violent gangs. And for reasons I can't say I understand very well, New York has never really had gangs the way that Chicago has gangs.
Indeed, while it's famously hard to get good data on gang numbers, law enforcement groups estimate that Chicago has more than 100,000 gang members, while New York, a much larger city, has only around 20,000. So it's easy to believe that that has something to do with Chicago's higher crime rate, although we should say that Chicago isn't even in the top 10 when it comes to the most violent big American cities. There's Detroit, Oakland, Memphis, St. Louis. In any case, Chicago is plenty dangerous, so much so that the Chicago Public Schools, the CPS, asked Levitt and some colleagues for help.
They were extremely concerned about the pattern of violence against Chicago public school students. So actual students who were being shot, not necessarily in school, almost never in school. It was something like 250 Chicago public school students were being shot each year, of which about 20 or 30 were dying.
The CPS had launched a program in 2009 designed to prevent violence and keep kids in school. It was considered particularly innovative. It offered full-time mentoring. It gave students part-time jobs. It was, however, an expensive program, about $15,000 per student per year. So the CPS wanted Levitt and his colleagues to help figure out how to allocate this precious resource. The plan was to pay special attention to roughly 200 kids who were considered most at risk.
And so what they asked us to do was to try to come up with a model, a statistical model that would help them figure out who they should target this program for. And so they gave us a really unique data set. We had the identities of every student in the Chicago Public Schools, and we knew a lot about them, about their grades and whether they came to school or not, and even about their criminal background, whether they had been sent to juvenile detention.
So Levitt got to work, along with a couple of colleagues, Dana Chandler and John List. They analyzed the identifying characteristics of students who'd been shot in the past in order to help predict which kids might be targets in the future. Some of the characteristics jumped right out at them.
The single best predictor of being shot overall, as is so often the case with crime, turns out to being male. It was almost exclusively boys who got shot.
Okay, no big surprise there. There were some other unsurprising traits.
Having been to juvenile detention, having dropped out of school, having low GPA, all of those things predicted who would get shot.
Race was a very prominent factor, or so it seemed.
an African-American boy was 20 times more likely to be shot than a white boy who was going to the Chicago public schools. And yet, once you controlled for information about the neighborhoods and the grades and the past history and things like that, the role of race really disappeared. So it was a case where the race of a kid was more a symptom of some of the behaviors that might be involved rather than actually the race itself was determining the being shot.
Okay, how well did your predictive model seem to work?
Well, it worked okay, but not fantastically well. We could isolate a group of kids out of sample who were about 20 times as likely to be shot as the average kid. So that sounds impressive when you think about it, but the likelihood of being shot is so low in the sample that actually we were only able to predict one or two shootings over this set of kids. So it's an interesting case about with statistics, how if you present it one way, wow, that's really impressive. But if you really dig down into it, you realize, wow, this is such an unlikely and random act, semi-random act, that we really didn't have much predictive power at all.
All right, so Levitt and his colleagues weren't much help on that dimension. But they also tried to figure out the efficacy of the program the school was already running, the program that tried to keep kids in school and away from violence. One component of this program was run by a national nonprofit called Youth Advocate Programs, or YAP.
It was one of these urban programs where they had mentors and they came in and they tried to coach the kids and teach them to do the right thing, that sort of stuff.
You sound so enthusiastic about it, yeah?
Well, once you know the results, it's hard to be enthusiastic about the program.
All right, give me the results then.
Well, the results were we really didn't see any effect at all. Now, it wasn't a perfect study because we, as much as we pushed and prodded on the Chicago Public Schools to run it as a randomized experiment, which you and I and a lot of other people have been advocating when it comes to doing social science, they weren't willing to do that.
That said, the study was good enough to learn what effect, if any, the program had.
The program didn't seem to have, really on any dimension, seemed to have changed the lives of these kids.
So what is a better model, knowing what you know about these interventions and how they didn't work, that would work?
Well, the conventional wisdom is that there's almost nothing that you can do to these kids that will help.
The idea is that a lot of our bad habits are pretty fixed by adolescence, and it's really hard to rewire a teenager who's already in trouble or heading for trouble. But is that really true? Or is it just a way to explain why society hasn't done a better job of helping at-risk kids and preventing crime? Today on Freakonomics Radio, we'll hear from a criminologist who did get to run a randomized experiment, the results of which just might rewire your thinking about crime and a lot of other things, too.
The first time that we saw these effects, we thought, wow, can this be right?
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Now we're in downtown Chicago, 9:30 on a Friday morning. Tony DiVittorio is running a meeting with about a half dozen men sitting on folding chairs.
Well, let's do a little housekeeping. So first of all, welcome. Yeah, great to cohort. Couple things going on. Number one, we're scheduled to be here till 4.
DiVittorio works for a Chicago organization called Youth Guidance, not to be confused with YAP or the Youth Advocate Program, different people. But Youth Guidance is also in the business of trying to keep Chicago public school students out of trouble. Today, DiVittorio is training a group of counselors.
So what's the goal for today? Today is to introduce the value of accountability, our fourth goal.
DiVittorio's background is in psychology. He'll drop phrases like hostile attribution theory and positive thought replacement. But he also knows what it's like to grow up in a rough neighborhood, like the students he's trying to help.
Born and raised in the southwest side of Chicago, so I had that experience of being an at-risk youth myself.
DiVittorio also calls himself a rites of passage elder. He's thought a lot about what it means to be a man, to become a man. He and his father had a difficult, distant relationship. DiVittorio has worked through a lot of old emotions, poked a lot of old wounds. And over time, he incorporated this thinking into his work with teenagers, and he built a program he calls Becoming a Man, or BAM. He'd get young men to sit down in a circle and talk about the authority figures in their lives, about why they shouldn't drop out of school.
I was working with these youth who were referred to me for anger issues, cutting class, yelling at their teachers, what have you. And I was operating within these different modes. I was a clinician, I'm a psychologist, doing counseling, having these boys explore the men they want to become and passing on this knowledge and getting them to do what we call a deep dive. I realized that whatever I was doing was effective because the teachers kept referring the boys. They kept seeing some emotional regulation with the boys. The boys kept coming back, opening up in these circles. And I sat down in 2001 and said, what is it that I'm doing? What's happening here?
It was only when he set his method down on paper, DiVittorio says, that he realized what he was doing.
Oh, I see. I'm doing cognitive behavioral therapy.
Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is a form of psychotherapy that's pretty common in mental health treatment, although not in the kind of social work that DiVittorio does. It's meant to be a short-term, pragmatic approach to helping people solve problems. As the name implies, it's meant to change behaviors without necessarily dwelling on the underlying psychological sources of those behaviors, as talk therapy does. CBT tries to get people to think differently about behaviors that have become practically automatic, to respond more thoughtfully to stress, and not just in a purely therapeutic realm.
CBT has actually, interestingly, been proven effective in lots of other domains.
That's Sarah Heller.
For depression and anxiety, for medication adherence, for smoking cessation, we know that CBT is a strategy that works in a short amount of time to change behavior. What we didn't know is sort of that it could apply to these other types of policy relevant behaviors like dropout and crime.
Dropout and crime. That is exactly what Heller wanted to learn about. She is a professor of criminology at the University of Pennsylvania. She also participates in the University of Chicago's Crime Lab, which is a network of researchers who try to find empirical solutions to crime and violence. And that's how Heller and her colleagues got acquainted with Tony DiVittorio and his BAM project. In 2009, the Crime Lab helped Youth Guidance raise nearly $1 million in funding. The Crime Lab's generous funding came with just one catch. BAM had to let Sarah Heller and the other researchers evaluate the program to see whether it actually worked. The key was to set up the project as a randomized controlled trial. The population of eligible students would be divided into a treatment group who'd get the CBT intervention and a control group who wouldn't. The random division was accomplished by lottery.
So, you know, everyone sort of appreciates the idea. There's no nepotism involved. You don't have to pick and choose which kids deserve to be in the program or not. Or on the more challenging end, the youth don't feel like they've been singled out because they're in trouble, right? It's just sort of the luck of the draw.
The kids who did get drawn were now placed in the BAM program. The idea was to teach them to slow down their thinking when they ran into challenging situations, to control their immediate impulses.
The basic theory rests on something that we're calling automaticity or automatic behavior. And automatic behavior is something we all engage in all the time, right? It's just behaving without consciously thinking about it.
And probably you just said it, without consciously thinking about it. There are probably all kinds of behaviors that we all do, whether bad behaviors or otherwise, that we probably think we're deciding to do, but we're really just doing purely out of habit or automaticity, yeah?
Exactly. And it's a good thing we do because it's actually very cognitively costly to think about every action.
Right. It would take forever. We'd never get past breakfast if we had to make every decision from scratch, right?
Right. I mean, think about even opening a door, right? If you have to consciously think, okay, there's the doorknob. Now I'm going to reach out and I'm going to clench my fingers around it, right? I mean, that's a very simplistic example, but there's all sorts of things that really require a lot of automaticity in everyday life. Oftentimes, automatic behavior is very adaptive. But in some circumstances, it can be maladaptive, especially when your automatic response is ill-suited to the situation that you're in.
Heller worked with several colleagues on this study from a variety of disciplines. Jens Ludwig, Sendel, Malinathan, Harold Pollack, and other academic heavyweights.
Think about a youth walking down the street in an upper-middle-class neighborhood. If someone comes up and demands his cell phone, probably his automatic response is going to be to hand it over and then go run and tell an adult. And he's built up that automatic response over many years of being in situations where that has become very adaptive, right? Where adults are reliable, where compliance is a constructive behavior. And so when that kid then shifts over to the classroom and the teacher says, "All right, everyone, sit down, it's time to start class," compliance might be the automatic behavior and it's very adaptive.
Okay, so that's that kid, but not all kids.
Right. So now think about a youth who's growing up in a much poorer neighborhood where there's a lot more chaotic environments, where compliance is probably not the adaptive thing, right? So there's a lot of evidence about street life in poor neighborhoods and how important it is to stand up for yourself, to show that you're not a victim, right? Because if you just comply with every request that comes your way, you're going to get beaten up quite a lot. And so there you might develop an automatic response that's a little bit maybe more aggressive, more assuming that other people are hostile, trying to avoid conflict until it comes, and then really strongly standing up for yourself. And so if someone in that environment says on the street says, "Hey, give me your cell phone," your response is probably going to be at least a little bit less polite than "here you go."
Right.
And so if you think about, right, what that person might do, there might be shoving or fighting, there might be some profanity. If you then think about that youth in a classroom where the teacher says, "Everyone sit down so we can start class," that might feel like automatically the same situation, right? Someone is challenging you. You might feel like something is at stake for you. But if you have that same aggressive reaction in front of the teacher, you're going to get kicked out of class. And so you can see there that it's not that the youth in a poor area is any more automatic, or that the rich youth are sort of behaving less automatically. Everyone's applying this automatic behavior, but youth in poor neighborhoods face so many different kinds of situations. Their situations are more variable. And when the context varies, that's particularly hard for automatic responses. You're going to be more likely to have a maladaptive response.
So how do you learn to interrupt that automatic response? That's what Tony DiVittorio and the BAM program are all about. The students in the program would participate in a variety of CBT routines. One of them is known as the fist exercise.
So the fist is very interesting. It's one of the first things that youth do when they're starting the BAM program.
It works like this. DiVittorio, or another BAM counselor, would bring roughly a dozen teenage boys into a classroom and invite them, not tell them, invite them to sit in a circle. More often than not, the boys do it.
And before I say anything, I say, "Find a partner. Stand up, find a partner, go anywhere in the room you'd like. Just don't stand on any tables, don't go by the teacher's desk."
And so they pair off.
And I say, "Listen, pay attention to what I'm about to say. One person be letter A and the other person be letter B in that partnership. Go ahead and decide."
The kids decide who's who.
And then I say, "Letter A, go ahead and make a fist."
Now all the A's make a fist.
"Letter B, partner, you have 30 seconds to open up letter A's fist. But hang on, let me give you the rules."
There's only one rule.
"There are no rules.
Go.
Open your fist, come on."
And you can imagine what happens in a room full of adolescent boys who have just been told there are no rules. All hell breaks loose.
They start beating the crap out of each other.
Right? Everyone's sort of chasing after each other, trying to get the fist open.
10 out of 10 times, they're physically fighting. Sometimes they do headlocks. Teachers are walking by thinking that we're out of control.
It goes on for about 30 seconds.
Time out, time out.
They switch partners. The other person closes his fist, so there's sort of equal opportunity bashing going on.
You do it again. Same thing happens.
It's utter chaos.
And then Tony will blow the whistle and bring everyone back for the debrief.
Their heart's elevated. They got a smile on their face. They've had some fun.
And he'll say, "Okay, how many of you succeeded in opening your partner's fist?"
Raise your hand. You know, maybe 3 people.
And Tony will say, "Well, that's interesting. It doesn't seem like a very difficult task. Tell me the kinds of things that you tried."
"How did you get the fist open, or how did you try?" And you go around the circle.
And they'll say, "Well, you know, first I grabbed his wrist and twisted, but he got away. So then I tried a kidney punch." And Tony's saying, "Interesting, interesting."
And I say, "You know, it's interesting. Not one of you asked your partner if he could open up his fist."
Right? No one ever asked the partner to open his fist. And Tony will say, "Well, why not?" And they'll say things like, "Well, he would have thought I was a punk. He never would have done it."
Or, "It wouldn't work."
And Tony will say, "Well, how do you know?"
"Well, how do you know it wouldn't work?"
And so this starts a conversation about how you know what other people are thinking and how you know how they'll react to things unless you sort of try and ask.
Now I go into lecture mode. They're at the edge of their seat. And I talk about, did you know that a powerful man, an exceptional man, is a man who is willing to ask for what he wants? Listen, there's times I got to take things. And I know being on the street, sometimes I have to be in that kind of thinking. But there's other times, man, where that ain't going to work. And I have to know how to ask for what I want. They're quiet. Their eyes are real big. They're hearing a soft skill.
It's a very engaging way to get youth to start to think about their own thought processes, to think about other people's thought processes, without having to sit down and give them instruction about what metacognition and thinking about their own thinking means.
So, coming up on Freakonomics Radio, will the program really work? Will it actually help prevent these kids from getting violent, from dropping out of school?
The fact that we see this over and over in different settings, I think, starts to build the case that there might be really something going on here.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We wondered how the fist exercise would work with the kids we heard from earlier playing basketball in Dawes Park.
Can I try this game with you guys?
We sent producer Bill Healy there. Healy modified the fist exercise. Instead, he used a water bottle. He gave the bottle to Deontay Griffin and told another kid he had to get it out of Griffin's hand.
So you gotta help me. All right, so basically, we got 30 seconds. All right, and you've got to get this bottle away from him, okay? And there's only one rule, okay? And that's that there are no rules, all right?
So he got to get the bottle out of my hand.
Uh-huh.
Again, the only rule was that there are no rules.
This would be fun.
They waited for the sirens to pass.
No.
20 seconds. All right. Ready?
And then came the countdown.
Go.
20, 19, 18, 17. 16.
All right.
I got an 18.
Now, here now, you gotta get it from him.
All right. All right. I'm in on a countdown.
All right. 20, 19, 18, 17, 16.
Yeah. It took me longer.
You know, the question they wanted me to ask then is, why didn't you just ask him for it?
That was a good question. I guess
That was just a game you just taught us.
But you know what? It's crazy because if you think about it, like, mentally, that is, like, I could have just asked for it. But I guess that's just something. That's just, it's like your subconscious tell you to take it. Like, I don't know. Like, instead of doing the right thing, which is asking for it, which would be something simple, you don't have to waste no energy. It's like you got to take it. I guess, I don't know. It's ironic because it almost relates to Chicago.
How?
Because, like, instead of doing something simple, keeping stuff simple, they try to just take everything. Like, even when people can't get jobs, what they do? They try to rob, steal, just take instead of doing the right thing and try to work for what they want and just maybe ask for it. That's what we need. That's what we need in Chicago because there's a lot of the men who grow up not around real men. So they don't really know how to carry themselves as real men. So when they grow up trying to be, you know what I'm saying, to be the people who they see. And those are their team, the peers, you know. And they ain't gonna do nothing but try to do things to make their peers feel accepted. Because a lot of kids down here, they don't really grow up with father figures who gonna really teach them how to be a man. That's why when they go out here in these streets, they try to do things like shoot somebody to make them feel like, oh, I'm a man. But really, that's not what it is. Anybody can kill somebody. Real men move their mom out the hood. That's what real men do.
Deontay Griffin hasn't ever been to BAM. He's never met Tony DiVittorio. But the lesson of the fist exercise, or in this case, the bottle exercise, seems to hold real promise.
Accountability.
As you have likely gleaned by now, DiVittorio has a pretty dynamic personality.
Guys, we're going to start up again.
He's sincere and he's funny. You can tell he loves working with young people and teaching others how to work with young people. During the training session for BAM counselors, he connects easily with the other men.
And we're going to have some fun now.
In addition to the fist exercise and drills like that, Di Vittorio likes to use role-playing. He wants to get kids to think critically about their own behavior.
My favorite one, I'll share with you. My favorite one is called High School Day.
High School Day is about learning to take an emotion like anger and channel it into something more positive. Di Vittorio talks to the kids about the difference between a savage energy and a warrior energy. The savage energy, he says, is a completely normal emotion.
And warrior energy is taking normal savage energy and making a choice to express it positively.
He has them act out situations they're likely to encounter in their own lives. One kid will play the role of a high school security officer who's filled with warrior energy, and another kid plays himself, a student, on his way to class.
You're the student and you're on your cell phone walking through the hall and you're filled with savage energy today. No one tells you what to do. You know, you come from the streets, man. You're badass, you know, that kind of thing. And then you have them act out these scenarios. They have a lot of fun with it. And then you process it. What was it like to be in savage energy? What was it like to be in warrior energy? Did you feel like a punk? And you get them reflecting upon that. And then you go into act two where maybe now the security officer is having a bad day. He or she is filled with savage energy, but the student, man, he's coming to BAM and he's trying to do this warrior energy thing and he's full of respect and this and that. And now the security guard officer is like, you got a suspension, you got this, you got that. And the student has to, in a role play, stay in warrior energy.
The boys learn what it feels like to not lash out, to not act on impulse. Then Di Vittorio sits them in a circle and they dig deep. They talk about their strong points. They talk about what trips them up.
And this is when the boys really open up. Man, every time I think about my father or, you know, something. And we start to see why it's difficult for this youth to come into the school and go to algebra class and sit there and learn algebra, because all the truth comes out in that circle. And we're able to really now get to some real concrete solutions to how to handle this.
What Di Vittorio and BAM don't do, says Sarah Heller, is tell kids how they should and shouldn't behave.
So they're not teaching youth never fight. That would be a stupid thing to teach youth in these neighborhoods. It's just trying to teach youth to slow down a little bit, be a little bit more reflective rather than reflexive in their thinking, and just think for those, you know, 5 seconds, what kind of situation am I in? Do I need to tamp down this automatic response or not?
So this all sounds good, right? CBT with at-risk Chicago teenagers, getting them in touch with their emotions and their automatic responses. But did it work? Fortunately, Sarah Heller and her colleagues now had the data to answer this question. The Becoming a Man study covered more than 2,700 boys in 18 public schools in Chicago from 7th grade through 10th grade. Now, a lot of these kids were already in trouble. Roughly a third of them had been arrested at least once before the study began. Now, remember, the researchers randomized the study so that half these kids entered the BAM program and the other half didn't. This allowed Heller and her colleagues to look at arrest and school dropout data in the 12-plus months after the BAM program began and compare the boys who got the treatment to those who didn't.
So the first year of BAM, we saw a 44% decline in violent crime arrests and a 36% decline in other non-violent, non-property, non-drug arrests. We see an increase in school engagement that we think might end up eventually, once the kids are old enough, improving graduation rates by maybe 7 to 22%.
Right. So the improvement is wildly large, at least to my eyes. It's almost, you know, I don't want to say too good to be true. I don't mean to imply that I don't believe it, but wow, it seems as though it really works, yeah?
I mean, I agree with you. I think the first time that we saw these effects, we thought, wow, can this be right?
So just to be sure, Heller and her colleagues did a second randomized study of another season of BAM counseling, fairly similar in scope to the first. The effects weren't as large as the first study, but still large.
Same program, different set of kids, are also finding about a 30% decline in overall arrests.
Even so, Heller and the other researchers wanted to make sure they were measuring the efficacy of CBT generally, and not just the BAM program. So the University of Chicago Crime Lab researchers ran a third experiment, this one having nothing to do with BAM. This one was a rather accidental experiment that happened at the Cook County Juvenile Temporary Detention Center, the JTDC.
Which is the youth detention center where youth go between the time they get arrested and when the court decides what they want to do with them. So on average, youth are there for only 3 weeks, although there's a lot of variability in how long youth stay. And historically, the JTDC has been a very challenging place. There was an ACLU lawsuit that ended up with the federal government appointing an administrator there who started a series of reforms. And some of these reforms involved cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, so the youth engage in CBT every day. And for various reasons, those reforms got frozen halfway through, such that half of the residential units within the center were operating under this new CBT-based system, and half weren't. They were operating under the status quo.
Oh, perfect for you then, right?
Exactly. So if you're a researcher, your spidey sense should be tingling right now. So we talked to the administrator and we said, well, how do you decide which youth to place in which centers? You know, do you try to keep youth separate by gang affiliation? And he says, no, I like to really mix them up. And we say, well, do you try to place youth who you think are going to benefit most from the CBT programming? And he says, no, you know, basically, it's practically random. And we said, really? Random, you say? How interesting. So we worked out a system with the staff to randomly assign whether youth went to the CBT centers or the non-CBT centers, which sets us up for an evaluation. And there again, we're seeing declines in return rates to the detention center 12 to 18 months later that are about 20% lower than in the control group. And so the fact that we see this over and over in different settings, I think, starts to build the case that there might be really something going on here.
Sarah Heller and her colleagues wrote up the two BAM studies and the JTDC study in a research paper. Given the evidence of sizable behavior change across all three interventions, they pointed out, it's worth noting what these interventions are not. They do not involve academic remediation or vocational education or job training or paid temporary jobs or internships or early childhood education or cash or in-kind transfer to reduce poverty. In other words, these interventions don't involve any of the conventional and often expensive treatments that are typically used. Cognitive behavioral therapy is relatively dirt cheap.
That's right. It's very low cost, especially in the detention center where the staff are already there, the building's already there. All you have to do is sort of, right, change what you're doing for a half hour a day. That is incredibly low cost. So the BAM program happens in schools. So when you're training mentors and bringing them into schools and you have some administrative costs, there's still a cost to the program. In that first year, it was about $1,100 per participant. But relative to the other types of interventions we think about, they're incredibly inexpensive.
So your evidence is compelling that these forms of CBT work, that these interventions work. What do you know about the lasting effect? In other words, is this a kind of, do you teach people how to make a different, less automatic decision that will help them in a number of ways, but that if they don't keep getting the CBT, then they'll kind of forget or revert? Or is there evidence that it lasts?
We have some short-term evidence on that right now. So for the first BAM study, the violent crime decline happened just in the first year, the year that the program was going on, and faded out in the second year. But the schooling engagement increase lasted through the year following the program. So similarly, for the detention center, we see reduced return rates 12 to 18 months later. We don't have enough follow-up data to sort of see what happens after that. But something I'd emphasize is that we have this idea in our head that the only way a program is good and works is if it has effects that last forever. And especially when you're thinking about something like violence, I think that's really the wrong way to think about it. Violence is incredibly socially costly. So if there's a way to reduce violent crime, even for just a year, at a pretty low cost, we should do it, right? You're having a cost-effective change. You're getting more back in sort of social benefits than you're spending. And in fact, because criminal behavior declines very quickly with age, so violence peaks in the late teens, fades out very quickly in the early 20s, if you're making a difference for just a year in someone's late teens, then you really might be making a difference in the lifetime number of violent incidents that's going to occur in that youth's life.
I don't know about you, but it's hard for me to not be intrigued by and impressed with the results of this intervention, especially considering how relatively simple and cheap it is. So, coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we wonder, what happens if you do choose to spend a bit more money, if you keep up the cognitive behavioral therapy, but also throw in some cash incentives.
It was literally 10 Andrew Jacksons in the palm of your hand.
This wasn't in Chicago or even the U.S., but in Liberia. And if you think it's tough getting a teenager in Chicago to stay in school, think about what it takes to turn around a former Liberian child soldier.
Child soldiers were always used in those kind of instances to torture. Even if there was a case where in such a person needed to be executed, they would always want to use child soldiers to do that.
CBT and cash payments in Liberia, that's coming up on Freakonomics Radio. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
All of a sudden, we heard of the war.
The war was a civil war, the first of two in Liberia, West Africa. It began in 1989. Johnson Bohr was 18 years old. This audio is from an ABC News report.
As rebels fire blindly, some duck for cover. There is little place to hide.
Bohr was in high school at the time, getting ready to move up to a vocational school. But he says he was conscripted into the NPFL, the National Patriotic Front of Liberia. That was a rebel group led by Charles Taylor, who would come to be known as an infamously brutal warlord. The NPFL was fighting against the government of Samuel Doe. When the war started, Johnson Bohr was thrown right into the action. He became a company commander.
So I was around when people were tortured, I was around when people were killed, because I was part of the rank.
The population of Liberia at the time was barely 2 million. During the war, roughly a quarter of a million people died, many of them civilians. Bohr told our producer, Christopher Worth, about one distinguishing aspect of the Liberian Civil War, the use of child soldiers.
There were a lot of child soldiers to understand that we even had a unit called SBU, Small Boy Unit, that were also headed by child soldiers. And they are not afraid to go anywhere that they are requested to go. They have not experienced life. So that fear of death will not be there, especially wherein if some of them are like the kind that are taking drugs and all that kind of stuff, or they have arms in their hand. So child soldiers were always used in those kind of instances to torture. Even if there was a case where in such a person needed to be executed, they would always want to use child soldiers to do that.
Did you have to be involved in something like that? Either ordering or execution or torture or anything like that?
Not really, but I could say most likely, because if you are leading the troop and you have a troop on you, we have a saying that what the unit does, the commander is responsible. You, the commander, will always be responsible for those kind of stuff.
Bohr was eventually wounded in combat.
I feel like I could have died because I went off. I was all of blood. So as soon as I got at the hospital, they had to like put some blood in me, drips in me.
But in the scheme of things, being wounded was not the worst thing that could have happened.
Because that was one way that you could get escape from the war. Either you run away, or if you are a wounded soldier, then they let you go because they know they can actually make use of you. And it was at that time that I left the war.
Charles Taylor's rebels prevailed, and he took over the presidency of Liberia for 6 years. He was eventually convicted of war crimes and crimes against humanity. He's now serving 50 years in a British prison. After two civil wars and more than a dozen years of on and off fighting, Liberia finally began to settle down. Elections were held, and the country tried to find a new normal. But it had to deal with the fact that a generation of its young men didn't really know what normal meant.
That's the problem that we face in Liberia, because of the number of child soldiers that were involved with the war, and their reinsertion into normal community is a very serious issue.
Liberia is a very small country. It's only about 4 million people.
That's Chris Blattman. He is an economist and political scientist at Columbia University who spent time in Monrovia, Liberia's capital.
It's tropical. It's one of the rainiest countries in the world. So picture a city in the middle of a swamp in a jungle, sort of like Washington, D.C., except run down, not just by the, you know, the tropics, but really run down by the war and years of decline.
Blattman is essentially a development scholar and therefore pays particular attention to poverty and the associated violence. He works primarily in Africa and is an advisor to the Liberian government. Liberia has made gains since the wars, but it's hardly flourishing. Gross national income per capita is $400. On the UN's Human Development Index, Liberia ranks 175th out of 187 countries. Adult literacy is below 50%. Life expectancy is only about 60. The homicide rate is about 10 per 100,000 people, which, just to put that in context, is about double New York City's, but only a little more than half as bad as Chicago. Even so, the U.S. State Department ranks the threat of robbery and political violence in Liberia as high. Chris Blattman has tried to forecast when and where violence may break out. Part of the problem, it seems, is an artifact of war.
So there was nobody whose family wasn't touched by the war. Almost, I'm sure every family, if they didn't flee, had somebody involved in the war in some way. Most people reintegrate very well. But years after the war, there's who knows what percent, but some chunk of these young men were still doing really poorly. So you have guys who have lived lives of violence who haven't reintegrated, some of whom are engaged in crime.
Johnson Bohr was seeing this firsthand. He was by now in his mid-20s. He had happened upon a couple of humanitarian organizations, and he'd been exposed to trauma healing and peace building, and he'd gotten some training on how to work with troubled ex-combatants who'd experienced a lot of the things he had.
So I was using those kind of skills to actually get into their midst with the new kind of skills that I have had to discourage them from going back to war.
In 2000, Bohr and another ex-combatant started an organization called the Network for Empowerment and Progressive Initiative, or NEPI. The idea was to help former soldiers and other young men who were in trouble or heading for trouble. NEPI partnered with larger international organizations, and at a conference in Washington, D.C., Johnson Bohr met Chris Blattman. It sounded to Blattman as if Bohr's NEPI was having a dramatic impact on the Liberians it worked with. Blattman wound up working closely with Bohr and his colleagues in Liberia so he could see for himself exactly what they were doing.
I think they stumbled somewhat accidentally onto CBT. They cobbled together curricula from the U.S. and who knows where, and training manuals and this and that and their own experiences, and they experimented all the time. And when I met them almost 15, 20 years after they'd left the war, they had this program that seemed to bring in these really outcast young men in one end and then with some probability spit out changed people.
Over several years, Chris Blattman went back and forth between the U.S. and Liberia, spending several weeks at a time in Monrovia. He and his collaborators, Julian Jameson, another economist, and Margaret Sheridan, a psychologist, helped Bohr and his team refine their curriculum and raise funding. They began recruiting young men who were known troublemakers, and they'd try to teach these men anger management and self-control using the same kind of therapeutic and role-playing exercises used by other CBT programs, like Becoming a Man in Chicago.
You know, you have to control your anger in a case where someone's trying to, say, provoke you or something nasty happens or somebody insults you. And so they might start in the classroom, the very basic, what's the baby step you take? Well, now I'm going to have you two stand up here, and now you've got to insult him. Right. And they know it's a joke and he comes up with some insult and everybody laughs. So it's not a real situation of anger. But the guy who's insulted now has to come up with something he has to say or explain what he's going to do and role play how he's not going to react.
Then the group would brainstorm ways to avoid confrontation, diffuse the situation. They'd talk about what works, what doesn't work. The leaders would also teach the former soldiers seemingly simple things they never learned to do. Go to a bank, buy food in a supermarket. Blattman says it was important for these guys to change their self-image, to be able to see themselves as part of normal society rather than outcasts.
So when you look at these guys, the average guy that we recruited was dressed a little bit rattly.
They had to cut their hair, they had to cut their nails, they had to take their bath, The only thing they think about is food and drugs.
And these guys know that stealing is bad. They know that drug dealing is bad, or at least that society considers it a bad thing. They know that drug using is considered bad. So they don't disagree on what the moral principles are in society. They just don't necessarily believe that that's their group. Like, why? That's bad for you, but that's not bad for guys like me. And so that was their image. That was their self-image. And so the goal was to actually get them to try thinking like mainstream society members.
So as part of the program, the men were encouraged to clean themselves up, wear clean clothes. The program even offered free haircuts.
A guy comes in with literally just a razor blade and a chair and will shave off your dread so that you basically have a shaved head, which is sort of the respectable look in Liberia.
Blattman wanted to learn just how much a person's self-image could change at this point and how effective it would be to teach life skills to adult men. Self-control, for instance. There's been a lot of research on how self-control develops in childhood, like the famous marshmallow experiments by Walter Mischel. Young children were sat in a room and offered one marshmallow, which they could eat right away, or if they chose to wait 15 minutes alone in the room without eating the marshmallow, they'd get to eat two marshmallows as a reward for their patience.
If you had to choose, would you like to have one marshmallow?
Yeah.
Or would you like to have two marshmallows?
And they look after 20 years at these children's life outcomes, and they find that the ones who display more self-control as a preschooler or even younger are more self-control associated with better jobs, better pay, less crime. And when they've had programs that try to build these skills, foster these character skills in very young children, like in preschool, those seem to have a big payoff in terms of less crime and better work and happier lives later in life. So this is terrific. We know this is really, really valuable. But I think there's been an assumption that adults are no longer malleable. And we need to throw adults under the bus and put all our social spending into preschoolers to have a better future generation rather than say these guys can actually change.
The CBT programs in Chicago proved remarkably effective with criminally inclined teenagers. How would a similar program work with criminally inclined adult men in Liberia? To find out, Blattman, Bohr, and their teams set up a recruiting effort. They approached 1,500 men in Monrovia, aged roughly 15 to 35, who more or less admitted to being involved in criminal activity, or what's known in Liberia as the hustle. Blattman says this could include anything from pickpocketing and robbery to some other kind of scam, often in combination with some legal ways to make money, small jobs, a little farming. Out of the 1,500 men they approached, they got about 1,000 takers. For the sake of the research, Blattman randomized them.
They knew that there was going to be a lottery, and we explained that some of you are going to get it, some of you are not. We're going to follow you over time. We're going to follow you over a year because we want to see how this works out. And so you're going to play what they call a lucky ticket in Liberia.
Blattman also wanted to try another element that the Chicago researchers didn't use, a cash incentive. Some of the participants in the study would be given $200. Now, in Liberia, $200 goes a long way.
$200 is about 3 or 4 months of what they could earn from their so-called hustle. So you could think of it like 4 months of wages. And we did it for two reasons. So first, cash was actually a way to measure a change in behavior. So if you're more self-disciplined, if you're more perseverant, if you're more self-controlled as a result of this therapy, maybe we'll see it show up in your spending. Maybe you're more likely to spend it on a small business and less likely to spend it on booze or a meal in the market.
So here's how the experiment was set up. Of the roughly 1,000 men who were recruited, one quarter of them, 250, wouldn't get any help at all. They'd become the control group. Another quarter of the men would get CBT. One quarter would get CBT and the $200 cash. And the last quarter of the men would get just the $200 cash. That way, Blattman could measure which of the treatments, if any, were effective. Johnson Bohr was among the first to see the results.
The results were very much remarkable. It was very successful.
Criminal behavior fell substantially among all three treatment groups.
If you got the cash, or if you got the therapy, or if you got both, within a month, you had shaped up. You were committing a lot less crime. So you're going from about one crime a week to half a crime a week, if that's such a thing. And you were less likely to be aggressive. You were less likely to be selling drugs by about half. So 20% of the control group I believe, was selling drugs, and that was about 10% if you received one of the treatments.
Now, you might argue that if you've just been given $200, you have less need to sell drugs. But still, these were the results after 1 month. But what did the results look like after 1 year? It turns out that the effects had diminished after a year for the men who'd received just therapy or just cash, but the men who received both therapy and cash were still doing much better.
And what we found is that these changes in their crime and all of these things we call antisocial behaviors, like aggression and cheating and things of this nature and everyday violence, those were still down a lot by about 40 or 50% in the groups that received both cash and therapy.
As Blattman suspected, receiving a big cash infusion let some of the men start up small businesses.
The guy who made the most money went out of town to a distillery, bought a giant barrel of some kind of alcohol, came back, and then sold it by the cupful and made a killing.
And yet, Blattman points out, a lot of the men who received cash, whether with therapy or without, had lost all of it. One reason is that robbery and burglary are pretty common in Liberia. Blattman's own office in Monrovia was broken into and his computers were stolen. But as Blattman interprets the data from his study, even if men lost their money, they were still better off because they got to adjust their self-image.
CBT is about practice. So the guys who got the cash got to practice being a businessman, had to put self-control into action by making self-controlled decisions with that money, reinvesting profits. They got to appear to themselves and to the community like normal, peaceful members of society. And so even after that was stolen away from them, after a few months, it's like maybe an extra 8 or 12 weeks of practice. Maybe it's like doubling the amount of therapy they had.
Blattman believes this is groundbreaking territory.
We think this is the first time anyone has tried anything like this in a developing country, least of all a fragile state with this kind of population.
One major caveat is that the study relies on self-reported data, which we've repeatedly warned you on this show to be leery of. In this case, the participants simply told researchers whether they'd committed a crime or used drugs and what they spent their money on. Indeed, Blattman was worried the subjects were just telling the researchers what they wanted to hear.
When we first saw these results, we thought, no way. This is just too big. We don't believe it. No one else is going to believe it.
So as a precaution, Blattman set up a validation group. Researchers followed around some of the subjects, roughly 1 in 12 of the men who were enrolled. They'd hang out for several days, talk with the friends and family. Blattman says they could see no difference between what the men had told the researchers and what they actually did, which of course makes it easier to believe the data on the men who weren't followed. Blattman also points out that what we generally consider a more concrete form of data, arrest records from Chicago, for instance, often exists in a sort of gray zone.
This is true of any crime study. So in the U.S., we say, oh, we feel better, we have arrest data. But I think the one thing maybe events of the last year in the U.S. have really brought to mind is actually the guys who arrested are, that doesn't necessarily mean you committed a crime. It might mean you looked like the wrong kind of person. So you can't believe that data, and you can't believe our data. They might just be telling us what we want to hear. So always take all of these things with a grain of salt. We're very cautious, but you know, we asked these guys multiple times, building a relationship of trust, and we went and we like hung out with them for as long as we conceivably could without it feeling really, really weird. Found no sense that anything was amiss with what we were learning.
And again, even if the Liberian study was half as effective as it was, at twice the price, it'd still be pretty cheap. It cost about $500 per person.
$500 per person is, for both programs, both therapy and cash, is a bargain compared to most development programs. So an average skills training program usually costs $1,000 or $2,000. The other way to think of it is, you know, we saw crimes drop by about, go from like 50 crimes per person to 25 crimes per person. So this is basically $20 a crime. So if what they were stealing in each crime was worth $20 or more on average, then society's actually better off before we even think about the changes in these guys, other aspects of their lives, like less aggression, less violence.
So even though these CBT studies in Liberia and Chicago are relatively tiny, Chris Blattman believes it's time to consider CBT as a viable tool in preventing crime, especially if, as in both the Liberia and Chicago cases, you can target the biggest troublemakers you can find.
We have evidence from Chicago and we have evidence from Liberia, and we have evidence from a lot of incarceration and other types of institutions in the U.S. So that's not enough to say, let's do this everywhere. But it actually looks a lot better than a lot of things we do. And it fits with the way psychologists think about human beings, who are pretty similar everywhere. So we think we should try this in a couple more places before going gangbusters and scaling it up, and which is our plan. But I'm optimistic this has a lot of potential for those 10 or 20 or 30,000 highest risk men in any given urban center.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe. Thanks.